back to one of the ancient world's most fascinating rulers, Cleopatra.
Shall we agree, you and I, upon what Rome really wants? It's always wanted of Egypt. Corn, grain, treasure. It's the old story. Roman greatness built upon Egyptian riches. You shall have them. You shall have them all, and in peace. But there is only one way. My way. Make me queen.
That is Elizabeth Taylor, the sultry star of the 1963 blockbuster Cleopatra. That movie, and much of the legend that surrounded Cleopatra for nearly two millennia, has left a lasting image of the Egyptian queen as a woman who seduced her way to power. But biographer Stacey Schiff says that's what happens to powerful women when men write the history. Schiff's acclaimed new biography portrays the Egyptian queen instead as a shrewd political strategist and a brilliant leader. Schiff talked with Anne Strangechamps about the real and the imaginary Cleopatra.
You have a woman whom we thought was Egyptian, who in fact is Greek. You have a woman who's renowned for her beauty, whom the ancient chroniclers tell us was not particularly beautiful, but was eminently charismatic. You have a woman who is immensely wealthy, who was really a lot more than the sum of her seductions, and who in fact was not Elizabeth Taylor either. So there was a lot to sort of move aside. And it's a fascinating moment in history. It's a moment where the whole world will change. With Cleopatra's death goes the Roman Republic, goes Egyptian autonomy. 30 years later, Christ is born, the Roman Empire begins, the Hellenistic Age ends. It's just one of those moments where a woman, which is the other attraction, plays a chief role in the evolution of affairs.
Well, as you write, she's a woman who at one point in her life, for a brief moment, held the fate of the Western world in her hands. How is it that we have arrived at such a misconception of her?
The misconceptions actually begin in her lifetime, which to me is one of the great paradoxes of the story. At the end of her life, Cleopatra is essentially declared an enemy of the Roman Empire by Octavian, who needs to wage war on her and on his former brother-in-law, Mark Antony. Because she is a woman, he has to make her into something much more than just a feckless woman. He has to make her into this eminently powerful, sort of deranged seductress. And that's elaborated on after her death by first the Latin poets who pick up the propagandist baton, and then later by pretty much every manner of chronicler. I mean, Dante has her in the circle of carnal sinners. Shakespeare does quite a good deal with her. The Romantics have a field day with her. And then, of course, by the time film begins, there are all kinds of variations on the theme of the conniving woman.
So who was Cleopatra? Can you put her in her historical context and tell us something about what her early childhood was like?
Well, she's one of five children born to Ptolemy the XII. This is a line of sovereigns who descend from one of the generals of Alexander the Great. So they're Greek, they're Macedonians, ruling Egypt after the death of Alexander. And their immediate predicament is how to hold off encroaching Rome, which has pretty much at this point gobbled up the Eastern Mediterranean, with a few exceptions, the wealthiest and most fertile of which is Egypt. She comes to the throne on the death of her father in 51 BC with a younger brother. And it's a somewhat murderous and savage dynasty in which pretty much all the children are raised to rule, and they do their best to sort of shuffle each other off stage so that they might have the chance to do so. So that Cleopatra is within that first year and a half on the throne, embroiled in a civil war against her brother. And in the course of that war, the next youngest sister will also attempt to dethrone her. So there's a real sort of free-for-all here among the siblings, who were clearly, to answer your question, all of them raised to rule. And we know very little about childhood, which was not a big seller in the ancient world, but we do know how Cleopatra was educated, which would have been in precisely the same fashion as Cicero or Caesar or any other well-born Roman, which would have been on a steady diet of Homer, with a lot of the Greek playwrights, Aeschylus, Euripides, Sophocles thrown in, with lots of written exercises, enormous amount of training in speaking, but mostly it was a literary culture with Homer as the foundation.
So here she is at 21. She has ascended to the throne of Egypt, an educated woman raised to rule, yet she's fighting for her kingdom's future against Rome. How does she meet Julius Caesar?
Well, Caesar arrives, interestingly, in the midst of his own civil war. He races to Alexandria, trying to himself do in Pompey, whom he has just defeated, only to discover that Pompey has already been done in by the advisors to Cleopatra's brothers. So Caesar washes up in Alexandria with really no immediate mission and without reinforcements to discover that he is a very unwelcome visitor, that the Alexandrians are not happy about having him there. And so he barricades himself into Cleopatra's palace. She is absent because she has been exiled to the desert by her brother. And her immediate problem becomes how to meet Caesar, how, in fact, to argue her case in front of Caesar, which is to get from the eastern Sinai, where she is camped with a bunch of mercenaries, somehow west into the city of Alexandria and into the palace grounds, which are barricaded, all of it undetected. And she does that in a most ingenious way, in a tiny little boat being rowed by a retainer under the palace walls, where she slips into a heavy-duty sack of some kind, and the retainer throws that sack over his shoulder and secrets her into the palace grounds. And that is all we know about her initial meeting with Caesar, but we know it must have gone well because shortly thereafter, she is pregnant with Caesar's child, and the two of them are allies in terms of fighting off the brother, whom they will defeat several months later.
So we don't know what exactly happened between Cleopatra and Caesar, but as you said, several months later, here she is pregnant and they're an item. What do we know about their relationship or about her? You said she wasn't beautiful, but obviously seductive.
You know, what's interesting is what we tend to focus on. I mean, Plutarch very clearly says, here is a woman whose powers of persuasion were extraordinary, whose presence was irresistible, whose charm was irresistible, and her looks were secondary. And of course, we've inverted that equation. He also tells us that Cleopatra, to speak to your question of education, that Cleopatra spoke 9 languages, and she could move easily from one to the next. And as we know from her relationships with Caesar and subsequently with Mark Antony, to move from one kind of man to the next very, very subtly and very easily.
She brought several things to the table. So one was her immense power, charm, her charisma. The other was the wealth of Egypt. You write that the Egyptian palaces made the Romans gasp. What was so luxurious about Egypt at that time?
Well, there are two things. First of all, Alexandria is at the time of is in Cleopatra's lifetime the center of the world. It is the seat of learning. It is the fashion capital. It is the sophisticated city. It has the library and the museum. If you wanted a doctor or a craftsman or a book or an animal trainer, you went to Alexandria. Rome, by comparison, was a muddy provincial backwater where buildings tended to collapse all the time and where you couldn't find a book, actually, if you wanted one. So she reigns, first of all, from the more civilized world, I guess you would say. And secondly, she is the wealthiest person in the Mediterranean world at that time. Egypt is an immensely fertile country. Its wheat is largely what feeds Rome. Everyone in Egypt works for Cleopatra. Everything they make or manufacture contributes in some way to her coffers. And so hers is, by comparison with anyone else's, really an astronomical fortune.
She was also very much a hands-on working ruler. She was a fiscal administrator, controlled her country's currency.
I guess that's one of the pieces where you really do realize how far our misconceptions are from the truth. I mean, here is a woman who runs an enormously bureaucracy-heavy, administration-heavy economy. Everyone reports to her. She has this tremendous number of advisors and of bureaucrats who come to her with reports of the sewing schedule, of the oil proceeds, of everything that ever happens. And she needs to basically spend her day dealing with economic matters, agricultural matters, foreign policy, military policy, and judicial matters. So she is very much a working dynast, hardly a woman who sat around all day and planned her seductions.
So eventually, things went very badly for Julius Caesar, of course. He wound up assassinated. Cleopatra she'd been in Rome at the time, had to flee, came back to Egypt, and then wound up famously with Mark Antony. How did that come about?
Essentially, after Caesar's death, there is a long and murky period in which it's unclear who will essentially inherit his mantle, who will succeed Caesar. And slowly, two people emerge as the obvious contenders. One is Octavian, who is Caesar's posthumously adopted son. He's the grandson of Caesar's sister. And Mark Antony, who had been one of Caesar's deputies. And essentially, the two men who do not like each other will divide the Roman possessions between them, and Mark Antony will take a charge of the East. Cleopatra, therefore, more or less reports to him as a client queen. And she is summoned by Mark Antony, in fact, to what is today southern Turkey for their first meeting so she can explain why, over those years when the dust was settling, she did not immediately help Mark Antony in any way and what exactly her allegiance is. And that is when she plans this extraordinary trip up the river, which we know from Shakespeare, who took it from Plutarch, in her golden vessel with her billowing purple sails and her clouds of incense. And she's arrayed herself on deck as Aphrodite with her handmaidens dressed as cupids and nymphs, and lyres are strumming. And she makes her way slowly up the river to Mark Antony, who, the poor dear, has been doing business in the marketplace. But when this apparition appears, realizes he's been deserted by everyone who's gone out to see the arrival of this goddess. And what she seems to be saying there is, I am a queen, you do not summon me. And also, I am in possession of a great fortune, and you are about to head off on a tremendously expensive military expedition. Don't you think I could be useful to you? So, you know, again, it's that wretched excess that so riled the Romans, but it's used to tremendously shrewd political effect. And I should say, shortly thereafter, she's pregnant with Mark Antony's twins. So yet again, she has this amazing ability to be pregnant by the right men at the right time. That I can't account for.
It didn't end very well for her. You know, eventually, here comes Octavian from Rome. Mark Antony commits suicide, and so does Cleopatra. What happened?
There is a battle fought at Actium in 31 BC, at which essentially Mark Antony and Cleopatra make a tremendous number of mistakes. And after that, it's just a matter of time before Octavian comes marching into Alexandria. Mark Antony and Cleopatra at this point have begged and pleaded and tried to negotiate with him for some control of the throne. Cleopatra has asked if she can hand her kingdom on to her children. Mark Antony has asked if he kills himself, could Cleopatra be spared? There's all kinds of negotiating. But there are very few answers from Octavian, who is pretty much merciless, and who in the fall of 30 BC will arrive in Alexandria, at which point, yes, Mark Antony commits suicide, thinking that Cleopatra is already dead. And then shortly thereafter, Cleopatra will kill herself as well, knowing that the alternative would have been to have been taken as a prisoner to Rome and paraded down the streets as a piece of war booty.
Stacey, I can't imagine the challenges in writing a biography like this, where the sources are all ancient. There pretty much are no eyewitnesses. How is the actual work of writing this biography different from the other biographies you've written?
I would say that it was a murderous and very trying 4 or 5 years. The hardest part was not having a voice. For years, I had thought this was a great subject, and I just couldn't see a way to do it. And you do have an occasional quote from Plutarch, which indicates that Cleopatra was not only charming and cunning, but actually very funny, or that she had quite a saucy sense of humor. And those, in a way, gave me the courage to start, but it was the lack of that voice that haunted me throughout, as it was the fact that at certain crucial moments, you don't know how she reacts. I mean, she's in Rome when Caesar is murdered. She has essentially banked completely on this man with whom she has a child, and he's gone. The rug has been pulled out from under her completely. How does she react? And of that, we have no record whatsoever. So you're essentially writing around these great unknowns. There was, on the one hand, a great frustration in that. On the other hand, it was a terrific intellectual challenge to see where the material would allow you to go.
Stacey Schiff, talking with Anne Strangechamps. Schiff's book is called Cleopatra, A Life.
The time has come, I think, for us to understand each other. Whatever else I may be, in your opinion, first of all, I am Caesar.
And I am Cleopatra, queen, daughter of Isis.
If I say so, and when I say so, you are what I say you are, nothing more.
Hail Caesar.
You, the descendant of generations of inbred, incestuous mental defectives. How dare you call anyone barbarian?
Barbarian?
Daughter of an idiotic flute-playing drunkard who bribed his way to the throne of Egypt.
Your price was too high, remember?
I've had my fill of the smug condescension of you worn-out pretenders, parading on the ruins of your past glories.
The future that concerns me.
If it is, keep out of my affairs and do as I say.
Do as you say? Am I to understand, then, that you feel free to do with me whatever you want, whenever you want?
Elizabeth Taylor and Rex Harrison in the old epic Cleopatra, which may not be historically accurate. It sure is fun to watch.